WILL are made possible with support from the Friends of WILL and from Sinfonia de Camera, presenting English Garden with Shaba Erde on viola on Saturday, February 7th at 7:30 p.m. at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. The program features works by Elgar, Walton, and Vaughn Williams.
In sports, the University of Illinois' men's basketball team hasn't had a lot of luck on the road heading into tonight's game against Wisconsin in Madison. Illinois has won its five conference home games by an average of 15.8 points, but the team's road trips have been a different story. Illinois opened its Big Ten road slate with an overtime win at Purdue, but lost its next three away from home. The Illini women host Michigan State tonight. The Illini will be looking for their third straight victory. The women Illini are coming off back-to-back wins for the first time since November after topping Indiana and Northwestern. The Edmonton Oilers will try to score their sixth consecutive win over the St. Louis Blues when they face off tonight at the Scott Trade Center. Four of those wins have come by one goal. The Calgary Flames open a three-game homestand tonight against the Chicago Blackhawks, who will be looking for their fifth consecutive victory in Calgary. The Blackhawks have outscored the Flames 14-5 this season. And a federal judge overseeing Barry Bonds' criminal case says she will likely exclude from trial three positive drug tests, though she's inclined to keep a recorded conversation between Bonds' personal trainer and former personal assistant discussing steroid use. U.S. District Judge Susan Ilston said during an evidentiary hearing today that her initial thoughts were to exclude the 2000-2001 positive tests seized by investigators during a Balco raid unless there is direct testimony tying the urine samples to Bonds. Bonds is charged with lying to a December 2003 grand jury when he said he never knowingly used performance-enhancing drugs. He pleaded not guilty to the charges earlier today. That's sports.
Today's programming is made possible in part by Ratio Architects, designer of the Busey Bank main branch renovation, on the web at ratioarchitects.com.
It's 2:42. Atlanta and San Francisco are two of many American cities where the only major newspaper in town is losing money. Financial analysts say they expect some big dailies to fold, perhaps as soon as this year. NPR's David Folkenflik takes a look at what this might mean.
Take a place like Hartford, Connecticut, a poor city in a rich state, home to the state government and three of the largest companies in the country. A few hundred thousand people start each day with the Hartford Courant, as I did recently on a visit there. I ducked inside Papa's Diner downtown.
Egg and cheese on an English.
I'll take a cup of coffee, too. A little milk, no sugar.
Okay.
And I took a look at the paper.
Front page, Senator double-billed for travel. Magnet schools in Hartford. Inside the paper, got pieces about prison guards needing raises.
Inside the diner, I found Robert Brown.
Well, I read most of the whole paper when I get a chance to. Basically, keeping up with what's happening in the town itself, you know, like layoffs, because that's a big part of the news today.
It is for Brown. He was just laid off by the city sanitation department.
You know, you get the street gossip and stuff like that, but that's not good news. You know what I mean? Because I don't really believe in gossip. What I read, you know, is better than, you know, it's a word from the mouth.
A few blocks away, at a cigar bar in the city's financial center, I met an out-of-work IT professional named Bruce Salisbury. He was drawing deeply while surfing the web on his laptop.
Currently, right now, I'm looking for a new position, and the thought hasn't even occurred to me to pick up the Hartford Courant and look at the job section. Everything's online. It's online, it's fast, it's immediate.
People are becoming more like Salisbury every day. That's threatening to papers like the Courant, which is the nation's oldest continuously published newspaper, older even than the Declaration of Independence. So let's let the Courant stand in for all papers facing tough times and take a moment to imagine Connecticut without it. For one thing, former Governor John Rowland wouldn't have faced corruption charges a few years back. Richard Blumenthal is the state's longtime attorney general. He says the Courant's tenacious coverage compelled authorities to investigate Rowland.
The old-fashioned muckraking, finding out that there was corruption, the bad guys go to prison, the system's changed, reformed, you know, the sort of basic American tableau of what it good newspaper does at its best.
The mayor's just been indicted on bribery charges. The Current was out ahead on that, too. The paper's exposed polluters and the deployment of mentally ill soldiers to Iraq. But it's not just about hard news. Julie Staff is marketing director for the Hartford Stage, a well-regarded regional theater, and she says the coverage and the advertising in the paper combine to drive ticket sales.
Even a bad review is important to us, frankly, because it still brings awareness to the community about what we're doing here at the theater.
To be clear, there's no reason to believe the Current will close. Yet circulation and advertising revenues are down. Its corporate owner, the Tribune Company, has filed for bankruptcy protection, and the Current is a lot thinner than it used to be. Its newsroom staff is roughly half the size it was a decade ago. The Current's top editor, Clifford Teutsch, didn't respond to requests to talk for this story. But people around town, like Trinity College president James F. Jones Jr., are following the paper's fate closely.
The New York Times is not going to write about the local basketball teams or the local color stories or, in our case, what is happening on the educational front in Hartford.
In the State House press room, unopened mail was piled high on the desk set aside for the New York Times. The Times stopped covering Hartford last year. Some in-state dailies no longer send reporters either. So the retreat by other news organizations makes even the diminished Current more relevant than ever. Tom Monahan is a reporter for the local NBC station.
There is not a news organization that doesn't check the paper in the morning to find out what they missed. And chances are, you know, smaller outfits, smaller radio stations, smaller newspapers, even us, we're not staffed the way a newspaper is.
Some promising blogs have emerged around the state. But on the best-known one covering politics, ctnewsjunkie.com, most postings are written by the same person. Mark Pazniokas has been a reporter at The Current for 24 years, and he offers this warning were his paper to disappear.
You lose a sense of community. If everybody is looking at dozens or hundreds of different news sources, you don't have the common point of reference that, and not to be corny, but are an important part of democracy and community.
Again, the Hartford Current is not in any particular danger. No more danger, that is, than any other paper around the country, facing precarious finances and a killer economy. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
The recession has hit the dairy industry hard. Wholesale milk prices are in free fall. Most dairy farmers are producing at a loss. NPR's John Burnett reports some are being forced to sell off their herds.
The sign in front of the Stephenville Cattle Company in Central Texas has two messages: thank God for Jesus and dispersal heifer sale. Today is one dairyman's worst dream. Don Beckendorf stands on the catwalk over the cattle pens with his big sad eyes, watching his Jerseys and Holsteins being herded into the auction arena, mostly to be sold for hamburger.
Do you recognize him?
Yes, sir. I see him twice a day.
His wife, Deanne, is next to him, bundled against the chill.
When you're up close and personal twice a day, every day, you see him more times than some people see their kids.
The twice-a-day milkings are over for good. Don Beckendorf is cashing out, the last of three generations of dairymen. He faced a cascade of problems. Drought killed his rye crop that he planned to use for cattle feed. An E. coli outbreak killed 60 of his cows last year. Then the credit crisis hit, and the bank called in his note on some new cows he'd bought when times were good, and milk prices tumbled. Dairymen are paid for raw milk per 100 pounds of liquid. Beckendorf got $24 per 100 weight last summer. Last month, it dropped under $17, and this month, it fell below $15 per 100 weight.
Next month, they say we're going to get from $9.90 to $10.60 for a milk. And a break-even somewhere around $16, $17 a hundred.
A stout man in a faded plaid shirt, Beckendorf pulls back his cap and scratches his gray hair.
When milk drops to $9.90, I'm afraid there's going to be a bloodbath. I really am.
His 20-year-old son, Daniel, has had to drop out of diesel mechanic classes to find work. Deanne plans to go into town to look for a secretarial job. Don isn't sure what he's going to do.
When the Lord closes one door, he opens another one. And as far as our family, we just have to see what he has in store for us. Now's the time to trust.
Milk prices were strong from 2004 to 2008, and milking cow herds across the nation grew. But since then, world dairy prices have dropped 28%. demand is down for dairy products, from milk to a cheese pizza. Exports are way down, too. For instance, the melamine milk poisoning crisis in China reduced demand in that huge market. Steve Larson, managing editor of Hordes Dairyman magazine, says this is the worst downturn he's seen in nearly 40 years covering the dairy industry.
We're somewhere in the range of 58 or 59,000 dairy farms, and we expect a good many of them to go out of business.
Back at the auction barn, sitting in the cafe, dairyman Bill Barton says, between bites of a cheeseburger, there's just too much milk out there.
The East Coast is full of milk. West Coast is full of milk. We're just drowning in it. Same thing wrong with GM Motors. Too many cars. Don't take a rocket science to see you're on broke if you can't sell your product.
One would hope that falling prices for raw milk would translate into cheaper milk at the supermarket, but they haven't. Retail milk prices tracked by the USDA have slid only slightly in recent months. Other players in the dairy supply chain, from milk processors to grocers, are not hurting as acutely as the dairymen. Like Don and Deanne Beckendorf, look for more American dairy farmers to watch their life's work end up at the auction barn. John Burnett, NPR News, Austin.
Yesterday, the new Interior Secretary, Ken Salazar, canceled some oil and gas leases in Utah that the Bush administration sold to energy companies just before leaving office. NPR's Elizabeth Shogren has more.
210, you want a bit of it? 210, are you all in? You all done at 200?
Just before Christmas, the Bush administration sold 116 parcels in southern Utah. Environmental groups challenged 77 of them in court. And yesterday, Interior Secretary Ken Salazar announced he was rejecting those controversial bids.
President Obama and I believe strongly that we need to responsibly develop our oil and gas supplies to help reduce our dependence on foreign oil. But we need to make sure that we protect our signature landscapes and cultural resources for future generations.
The canceled parcels cover 130,000 acres. Some are near Arches and Canyonland National Parks. Kathleen Sagama represents the Independent Petroleum Association of America.
We're wondering why the administration is implementing policies that will limit economic development in the West, decrease our energy security, and make addressing climate change even more difficult.
Sharon Buccino, a lawyer for Natural Resources Defense Council, applauded the decision.
The beauty and the solitude that you gather from these wild lands is irreplaceable, and it's simply not worth the minuscule amount of oil and gas that's there.
Salazar left open the possibility that these parcels may be offered for lease again after the Obama administration assesses them. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News, Washington.
An exhibit underway at Chicago's Museum of Contemporary Art gives insight into what it's like to be deaf. Chicago artist Joseph Grigley uses video, audio, sculpture, and paper to take a funny and touching look at communication. Along the way, he plays homage to mundane conversations about things like kitty litter that we take for granted. Lynette Kalsness of public radio station WBEZ in Chicago has this report.
If you can imagine going deaf as a kid, think about the audio that will be stuck in your head. For artist Joseph Grigley, it's commercials and the Gilligan's Island theme song. That's why he calls one of his pieces, "Remembering is a Difficult Job, but Somebody Has to Do It." He sings about Gilligan from a TV screen framed by palm trees and a huge screen showing icy water.
With Gilligan, the skipper too.
Grigley had already lost most of his hearing from a fever when he was little. Then, when he was 10, he was out playing King of the Mountain. He got pushed off the hill, went rolling down, and landed on a stick that went in his good ear.
It's kind of weird, though, because you open your eyes and reach the bottom, and all the friends are standing over you, and they're waving their arms, and everything was weirdly quiet.
He says it was like watching the world with the sound turned off. He was deaf from that moment on. When Grigley's talking with someone, he'll often ask them to write a note to aid communication. One day, after dinner with a friend, he found scraps of paper all over the studio. He laid them out and was intrigued by the strange fragments of words and drawings. Nothing made total sense.
And yet it made sense by not making sense.
That was the starting point for him to make art. Now he saves all those notes. He mounts them on the wall in loose narrative form. They say things like, "Too much whiskey, but I am a painter." he bit my nose, or I don't think the monkey can be made to want to fish. His wife, artist Amy Vogel, collaborates from time to time and often interprets for him.
Joseph and I often talk about how, you know, you can hire interpreters for often really important things, but not for overhearing. And in schools, kids get interpreters for class, but not for the playground or the lunchroom or in the bathroom. So those little everyday things really do have a kind of meaning.
Grigley likes to imagine that every word we speak becomes a material object, and he envisions the words piling up in the garbage or taking over the kitchen. Amy Vogel explains.
Looking at Joseph's work, it does come back to sort of the humor and, I'll say it, beauty of like the everyday and just the subtle differences in all of us as human beings.
Ed Russia.
A piece called You features five silver speakers hanging from the ceiling. A series of people try to say the name of artist Ed Russia.
Ed Russia.
Comes out from the time when a lot of people were talking about how my work's about my deafness, and I'm trying to explain, no, it's not about me, it's about how other people communicate.
Like when they write him notes and can no longer rely on the flourishes of speech to get their message across, or when there are mistakes in lip reading, like in his video installation, St. Cecilia.
Johnny wants a pair of skates.
On one screen, a choir sings traditional Christmas songs. On the screen next to it, you look at the choir and you'd swear they're singing the same thing. But you walk to the other speaker and you hear this.
Johnny was a bastard child, Doozy wants a collie.
Yes, they are singing Johnny was a bastard child and Doozy wants a collie. Grigley gathered mistakes people make lip reading to create these lyrics. A friend asked Grigley once what he does with his anger over being deaf, because it's the humor, not the anger, that shows in his art. Grigley says it's like renting a storage unit on the edge of town.
I kind of keep the anger right there, but someday I'll have to go back to that storage unit and clean it out and make something out of it.
Until he's ready to deal with anger in his art, he wants to share the wonder he feels in everyday conversations about cat litter and ice fishing. Lynette Kalsnith, WBEZ.
Earth and sky.
In June 2007, a NASA spacecraft observed a large temporary breach in Earth's magnetic field. This discovery has been helping scientists understand how particles from the solar wind penetrate the protective magnetic shield around our planet.
The solar wind drapes around the Earth's magnetosphere. It's like the tentacles of an octopus.